Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hafa day, Minsing Wow, and Manahila Ekatapul, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Egi Tupol. On the show today, Samoa's new Prime Minister bans the country's only daily newspaper.
Hey, Mediterranean, I'll make tell my fafo.
While abroad, I noticed false reports claiming some of my CEOs held meetings related to my meetings abroad. There were also several misleading stories and photos circulated publicly for the world to see.
And 15 years after it became a democratic state, is democracy working in Tonga, especially leading up to its elections this Thursday?
Parliament is unable to check itself. It forces the king to get involved in the political process because the House is unable to check itself.
And a new interactive map, thanks to a think tank in Guam, will track military and geopolitical activity in the region. All that and more. But let me take this time to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, known as Melbourne. As always, I say min lau. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Samoa's new Prime Minister has banned the country's only daily newspaper from covering its press conferences, accusing it of publishing misleading articles. La'auli Alemaliatoa Leo Tia Schmidt announced the ban on the Samoa Observer at his first press conference since returning from 8 weeks medical leave in New Zealand. During the media event, he ordered the newspaper's reporter to leave the room and said the ban would also apply to his ministers as well. Though in a statement released late yesterday, the PM seemed to walk back the restriction, describing the ban as temporary. For more details, though, we're joined by our Samoa reporter, Adele Fraun. That Manuela Tayao, Adele?
Tayao Manuia Age.
Well, thank you for joining. This is a very interesting situation. If you could just take us through, what has the PM actually had to say and his reasons?
Yes, during yesterday's press conference, Prime Minister Lauli Maliatoa Plante Valfossi Schmidt, kicked off his, statements by addressing the issue or his thoughts about the Samoa Observer. So he went directly and addressed the issue, stating that there will be a ban on the country's only newspaper or daily newspaper, and then started stating that there were various reasons why he made this decision. And some of those reasons include, he said that the Observer published an article stating that his CEOs or heads of his government departments that he's looking after had a meeting or, held a meeting, allegedly held a meeting to discuss matters pertaining to his stay in New Zealand and also the meetings he had. However, the chief executive officer of his ministry came to correct the Samoa Observer's article stating there never was a meeting. So these were just some of the reasons why the Prime Minister said that, he wants to ban the Samoa Observer. It's through, according to him, incorrect articles. And then the most recent event was on Saturday, 16th of November, after returning home. He said only 10 minutes. He was just arrived at home 10 minutes. He was meeting his family's children. And then the Samoa Observer newspapers reporters and photographers. Well, he alleged that they trespassed and tried to access his private residence without invitation, hence why they were stopped by police at the gate. Now, he finds that the observer's approach was rude and invasive. So he calls the overall approach by the Samoan observer's lack of respect. So, yes, these were some of his reasons behind the ban.
Well, thank you for that, Adele. Yeah, are you saying that the only misleading articles, this is the reason as to why he has banned the Samoa Observer?
It's not just that one. Another article that he mentioned was the article quoting the Ministry of Foreign Affairs suggesting that he was advised not to meet foreign leaders while under medical leave. That was also one of the stories that he flagged during the press conference. And also another article that he was referring to was regarding the chair, the wheelchair that apparently was used during a meeting with the New Zealand Foreign Minister, which was flagged as fake. So there's a couple of articles that he was referring to, and yes, he says that the Samoa Observer was trying to discord his absence, and so yes, it was creating a lot of discord really during his absence, according to the Prime Minister.
Adele, we understand that the Prime Minister obviously had a confrontation also, right, with journalists at his home over the weekend, which we will actually try and unpack later in the show. But however, as a journalist in Samoa, is it uncommon for journalists to go to officials' homes?
In my years of experience as a journalist, no, it's not uncommon. And also, the Samoa Observer has done this before for other, for example, government officials. They've also done this with CEOs as well. And it's not new. To be honest, it's not new for this to happen. It's normal. It's a normal process. It's just a matter of if the reporters get to the homes and they're not allowed to, that's basically they're not allowed to enter the premises. It's a private property. But yes, there are cases that if they do visit the homes of government officials, they are allowed to do interviews. But that all depends on who they're visiting, I guess. But no, it's not new to the Samoa media for this to happen.
Now, I know that Lauli is not the first Prime Minister, right, that the Observer has actually gotten offside with. Is that right? Or who else has sort of been in, I suppose, has had a situation with the Observer?
Well, if I recall correctly, it's the former Prime Minister, Tula Epa, had his fair share of times. He did not agree with the Samoa Observer at times. So it's not new to the Observer to get this sort of treatment. It's not new for them because over the years there's so much history. The paper has been, in operation for so many years, over 40 years now, and they've gone through so many governments, they have experienced all sorts of, these sort of in relation to what they're getting now. Gone through so much, and according to the Prime Minister himself, he gives credit to what the Samoa Observer's chief editor, Savia Sanumalifa's stance is, and he applauds his work for all these years. But according to the Prime Minister, he says that there are new people at the helm of the paper and he does not agree with how they're operating. So these were just some of his statements during the press conference.
As you said, Adele, the Observer has been around for years. So I'm wondering, how culturally embedded is the Observer, within the community? Like, do you think people will actually sympathise with the paper? Have you had much public reaction to this ban?
Well, I've seen mixed reactions, to be honest. Some have supported the Samoa Observer stance. They are, you know, encouraging the Samoa Observer to continue doing their job, you know, keeping government accountable, asking the hard questions. You know, that's being shared on social media. However, there is also feedback from those that do not support the work that the Samoa Observer does. And they are applauding the Prime Minister's new move, stating that, you know, they are allegedly spreading misinformation, basically. So there's two sides to it. And it's mixed reactions really right now. But there are those that stand for the paper. Yes.
Well, Adele, look, we just really appreciate you being on the show this morning just to give us really what has been happening there in Samoa in regards to the Samoa Observer. We will actually be speaking with the editor later in the show. So again, whaftai te lava for your time.
Oh, whaftai te lava, Aggie.
Thank you. That, of course, is our Samoa reporter, Adele Fruin, here on Pacific Beat. While we head to Tonga, where the country's national election is underway, with voters in the kingdom heading to the polls on Thursday. But 15 years after Tonga became a democratic state, questions are being asked on whether Tonga's democratic reform has progressed. The government was recently criticised for allocating permanent seats to hereditary chiefs, as well as allocating the ministerial portfolios of foreign affairs and defence to the monarchy. The ABC's Finau Fonua spoke to political commentator and editor of the Tonga Independent News, Te Vita Motulalo, about whether democracy is working in Tonga.
At the moment, Parliament is unable to check itself. It forces the king to get involved in the political process because the House is unable to check itself. So I would probably rather prefer a two-chamber system like the Australian system, where, you know, there's checks and balances within the Parliament itself.
Just to clarify, when you say upper chamber, you mean like the noble reps?
Yeah, yeah. See, that's another definitional issue. The noble reps were elected by the nobles and in some instances are defined as representatives of the nobles, right? Whereas, as opposed to, and they're sitting from the other bench, opposing side, are the people's representatives who are then elected by the people, for the people, in opposition to the nobles, who are elected by the nobles, for the nobles, right? This is the standard translation of their roles right now. Out of the naming system we've given them, these are nobles reps and these are people's reps. The real essence is they are both representatives of the people. The nobles are a bit constrained in that the nobles are too powerful an institution on their own to also be given a popular mandate. So in a way, the way they are being constrained is to limit their powers by them competing among themselves for their own for votes. The best way to understand is that they're both representatives of the people, only that the nobles are representatives of the territories, the history, the continuity of their power and their kāinga and their territory. Not so much different from a senator, who brings in as a representative of a state and the cultural milieu of that territory and their history and the sensitivities and sensibilities of that territory. At the previous parliament, there was 9 nobles and 9 representatives, and the rest was the cabinet. That would have been an 18-member perfect upper chamber, make all the representatives in that house life peers, and, you know, we should have just left the old system as it is and added a new chamber for representatives. So that's kind of my view at the moment.
Do you think it's becoming less of an issue among voters in the elections?
The reform? Yes, it's a single issue. Reform, generally still discussions, but these are mostly related to the effectiveness of government services. We're still a developing country. There's still a lot of practical life-related services to be. That's more what people are focusing on. The majority of the popular discussion during election campaigns is about, you know, lives and livelihood, education for children, and so forth. And then you have probably, you know, outstanding matters is part of that is the democratic reform. It's not center stage anymore.
You wrote a piece on how Tonga's protectorate era, its 70 years as a British protectorate, is often overlooked in terms of how that contributed to where Tonga is now as a democracy. Could you expand on that?
One thing that is not fully celebrated, which is part of our institutional building, is we also forget we had 70 years of protectorate rule by the UK. So that is 70 years of operating without having to consider the strategic realms of foreign policy and defense, because it is also the subject that's now currently held by the king. Yeah.
And then right now that we see that it's with the king. You think that's been adopted from the protected area?
Not necessarily, but I think the view from the crown is that it's probably because we haven't demonstrated an ability to operate these very sensitive responsibilities responsibly and effectively, and not involved in our, you know, day-to-day politics. After all, half our budget is from there anyway. I don't think it's necessarily an adoption of the protectorate system. I think it's just a measure it's a lot more sensitive area to be embroiled in our day-to-day intimate politics where we get involved here on the ground.
And that was Te Vita Motulano, editor of the Tonga Independent News. Now, a month after the death of former Malaita Premier Daniel Sudani, charges of unlawful assembly against him have been formally thrown out by a magistrate in Honiara. Mr. Sudani's co-defendant, his advisor, Celsus Talifilu, has been set free by the same court after he was told he had no case to answer. The charges against both men were linked to the riots in Malaita in 2021. Mr. Talifilu says he believes the case took a heavy burden on Mr. Sudani and caused his health to deteriorate, while for him a huge burden on his mental health has been lifted.
At least psychologically, I can do things freely now, rather than before when this issue was hovering around my head and it affects the way I've done my work. But today I'm really glad and happy that finally justice has been served and now I'm a free man.
Look, you've come over a year with this case and along the way you've lost your friend, former Premier Daniel Sudani. How has the passing affected you?
So the passing away of my former boss and a friend really affects, you know, me as well. These are natural things that happen to people when we are not able to look after our health. Definitely we'll be succumbed to the burden of sickness and medical. But I felt sorry for him. I think to some extent he was really affected more than me in terms of the case. He confided in me several times that because of the relationship between us and the primary person that took the case, Asilawa, he felt very downhearted about it as being relatives. So I think that affected him more than me. And after all, he was the elected person. And most of the publicity, most in the local media, for him, he hasn't taken it on a broader, clearer sort of approach. Whereas me, I think I'm able to do that. So that too been a burden on him, in my view. And he confided this to me, that the way newspapers especially been portraying him in regards to the charges were pinning him down as being, the public court that making judgment on us. But although we've been together, we are two different individuals. So I feel that he has not taken it the way I took it. Very burdensome for him. And that affected him a lot in the way he was handling the matter and how he personally handled things in terms of his sickness. He was not a happy man. Of course, I've encouraged him that all this will come to an end. But I feel Very sorry for him.
Are there any specific lessons that you've learned during the trial that you feel are especially important now?
I think what is important, especially during the trial, is just consistency. You just have to be there. As an individual, I would like the matter to be resolved as quickly as possible, but the system has its own way of dealing with matters. It might not be of my liking, but things happen the way they happen. It's expensive, truly. That's one thing. Of course, we have the public solicitor who would have been able to help in this, but I feel the system needs, in terms of the court system, needs to assist the citizens of their rights. That's what they are established for. If they are not able to do that, it will be very difficult for individuals to able to get matters and stand for their, you know, their side of the story in the court. What I've seen is the student and I were able to go through this with support of friends, that we were able to meet the legal fees for our lawyers, and still outstanding, but that's the tough bit when you take case to the court and then you have to meet the fees. If you want a good lawyer, it's going to be expensive. Relying on public solicitor, I have never used them. We were trying to use them in the beginning of this, but I think they have a lot of activities to fulfill as well. And I personally do not understand how they operate, how they help people too. So maybe a little bit more of public awareness of their roles would help people to reach out to them.
And that is Celsus Talifilung, former advisor to Daniel Sivdani, the late premier of Malaita province in Solomon Islands, now a free man after charges of unlawful assembly against him were dropped and the case against Mr. Sivdani was formally dropped. Mr. Talifilung was talking to Krishnarita Almanuleong in Honiara. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. As always, this is the time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines. And of course, I'm joined by our producer, Carl Evans. Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
It is the season. It is the season. We are approaching the holiday season.
It is.
Countdown is on.
I can't wait. Hey, look, there's quite a few stories from around the region. We are starting off with this one, who I know a lot of people were worried about, Tongan Rugby League star Elias Sakatoa. You know, when he was injured, but he's set to return to Melbourne, though, to continue his recovery from that head knock suffered at the Pacific Championships. What's the latest?
Yes, there has been an update. Melbourne Storm CEO Justin Rodsky fronted the press yesterday to give an update on his recovery after he suffered those multiple head knocks and seizure activity during his nation's clash against New Zealand about a fortnight ago. Now, as we know, the clash, the first head knock happened in a pregame warm-up. Then he suffered two more during the game, which ended up causing him to suffer bleeding on the brain.
Yeah.
He's since undergone brain surgery at a hospital in Auckland, where he's been ever since. Mm-hmm. However, it can be confirmed he will now return to Melbourne. Now, here's what the Storm CEO had to say.
Yeah, so at this point in time, the plan would be that he returns to Melbourne and returns to hospital for a period of time for further assessment, to see some specialists here, to be under the care of our doctor here. And then I think at that point they'll make the decision on when he's discharged from there and what his recovery looks like from there, whether that's heading home, whether that's heading into some form of rehabilitation centre, something like that. It's probably a little bit too early to tell on that. We're in the process of working through when he gets out of hospital in New Zealand. Hopefully it's in the next 24 to 48 hours, and then the view would be to get him back to Melbourne early next week.
Well, look, Carl, I know that a lot of people have been very concerned about him, you know, and have really rallied around Eliezer. Mm. But I think the update that I suppose a lot of people are asking is there an update on his rugby sort of league future?
Yeah, that question was put to Mr. Rodsky. And look, it's a fair one. As the CEO said during his press conference, he's been probably one of their best two or three players in the last 3 years. However, not surprisingly, there is no timetable for his return. In fact, it's not even being discussed, nor is it a priority at this stage.
Mm-hmm.
And look, he did say, look, while there had there are have been some positive signs in terms of his recovery. He still does have a long way to go, according to all reports.
Okay, well, look, thanks for that update. We head to Vanuatu. This is an interesting story. They're cracking down on expired and unsafe food. What's the latest?
Yeah, that's right, Aggie. So the Vanuatu Bureau of Standards, didn't even know there was a bureau of such a thing, but it's conducting surveillance of food products sold in shops in Port Vila and Luganville. So this is reported by the Vanuatu Daily Post, who have been witnessing the seizure of expired food items during multiple inspections over the past fortnight.
Wow.
Where authorities have been confiscating expired foods. So among those being removed were products with things like missing labels or damaged packaging. Mm. Others, meanwhile, have been taken for lab analysis to see if they pose any health risks. However, it's eggs that seem to have authorities most worried,
okay.
Just given that they're transported in containers under controlled temperatures, but are later exposed to different conditions upon arrival to Port Vila and Luganville.
Mm.
So during that period, they can go bad, and in some places have been going bad. So hence this operation. It is a first of its kind, and the findings will provide policymakers with a clear picture of the quality of food available to consumers and help raise those national food standards to ensure that the people of Vanuatu are consuming safe products. And I can tell you, Aggie,
I think that's a good way to go.
Well, as someone who has suffered food poisoning in recent weeks, this story speaks to my heart.
Well, definitely. Well, let's hope that crosses the line and we do see, safe products for our people there in Vanuatu. Okay, well, heading back to sport, though, because there's some big news with the Flying Fijians. They're set to play in a new competition.
Huge story, this one. So the FRU has confirmed the Flying Fijians will be competing in the inaugural Nations Championship. So this is going to kick off in July 2026, with Fiji and Japan making up the two invitational sides that will join Southern Hemisphere teams like New Zealand, Australia, South Africa and Argentina. And they'll compete against Northern Hemisphere teams, including England, France, Ireland, Italy, Scotland and Wales.
Wow.
So it's like this, combination of the Six Nations and the Rugby Championship, formerly known as the Tri Nations, sort of combined in one for this great sort of competition to take place in between the World Cup. So, I personally love it. Like I said, it's going to be held every 2 years, the first being next year, then again in 2028 and in 2030. And it basically sees 12 of the strongest rugby nations put into one single premier competition.
Okay.
So each nation will play six matches across the hemispheres, which means northern teams will play in the south in July 2026, and the southern teams will then travel to the north in November.
Mm.
And the finals, Aggie, will be held in London.
Well, you just briefly said there that you like this type of competition.
I do.
This works, because I know a couple of times we've spoken about how some of these competitions don't work.
This one makes sense to me. I always like it when they provide more opportunities for international teams to get on the field and play sort of, outside of their clubs. I know it can be hard to find the time because they have such busy schedules, but now look, when it comes to a sport like rugby union, I do think international competition is the pinnacle of that sport, unlike, say, rugby league, where it would be the club product. So, I think it's a great story.
Nice. Okay, well, again, you said the finals will be held in London. Speaking of London, I hear the PNG Cornwalls are slowly taking over their rugby league club.
Literally, Aggie. They are taking over the London Broncos, which is, the biggest rugby league club in London. So the London Broncos are set to add yet another PNG star to its ranks with the signing of Cornwall's halfback, Guillermo Voro.
Mm.
So he's been a star of the Hunters side across 20 appearances, 22 years old, made his Cornwall's debut in autumn. And he's reportedly agreed to head to the British capital, where he will link up with his Cornwall's teammates, Morea, Finlay Glare, Robert Matthias, not to mention Jason Demetrio, who is the coach of that side as well as the coach of the Cornwall. So it's, literally a PNG takeover. I'm absolutely here for it. Now, just to clarify, actually, the London Broncos, they don't play in the English Super League, as I mistakenly said they did. I think it was last week. They actually play in what's called the English Championship. So much like soccer, rugby league over there, it's like a tiered system. I'm not sure if there's I'm not sure if there's promotion relegation, but I do know that the English Championship is the second best competition, okay. Not the top, which is the Super League. But look, I think it's still an incredible story. Yeah, like I said, London is obviously the biggest city in Europe. This is their biggest, this is the biggest rugby league club within that city. So I think for a number of PNG players to get an opportunity there, what a platform to showcase what they can do and probably earn a bit of money as well.
Absolutely. Hey, look, well done to those PNG players who have made that team. But as always, Kyle, thank you so much for bringing us our headlines from around the region.
Thank you, Aggie.
And recap on the show so far. Samoa's new Prime Minister has banned the country's only daily newspaper, accusing it of misleading headlines. And 15 years after it became a democratic state, is democracy working in Tonga? Still to come, a new interactive map, thanks to a think tank in Guam, will track military and geopolitical activity in the region. And we speak with the editor of Samoa's Observer to find out what really happened at the Prime Minister's house. All that shortly here on Pacific Beat.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, Micronesia might be in our own backyard, but outside of the Pacific, it remains a mystery to many people. The region is at the centre of geopolitical competition between the US and China and is a hive of US military activity. While much of what happens is hidden from public view, including from locals, that's about to change, thanks to a new interactive map created by Guam-based think tank, the Pacific Center for Island Security. It's called the Micronesia Security Monitor, and it will track military and geopolitical activity in the region to inform locals of what's happening and the forces that threaten them. Here's Carl Evans speaking with one of the map's authors, Leland Bettis.
Our mission is to bring attention to the geopolitical, geostrategic issues that are happening in the Micronesian region. And so the map was a way to visually demonstrate what is unfolding in the region in terms of the U.S. military footprint, and then to build on that footprint piece by looking at all the range of activities that are going on. So if you think about, you know, new developments that are going on in the region, ongoing military exercises that are occurring in the region, I think with, you know, increasing frequency, and multilateral exercises that are occurring with increasing frequency. You know, we track everything from, you know, government vessels on the U.S. side to also looking at, you know, Chinese research vessels, which I think are telling us a lot about the way, you know, both of the geopolitical players see the Philippine Sea area and our region. So the idea was to sort of build framework that was accessible to the average person to look at what is occurring, and then to layer into that ongoing activities and current activities, whether that's news items related to the contest between the U.S. and China, or local concerns that are rising in the media throughout the region.
Yeah, well, one of the things that surprised me about the map was just how detailed it was. Like, it obviously had your geopolitical projects, you know, the stuff that's happening on the ground. It had things like undersea cables and treaties and things like that. But it also had, like you mentioned, it really detailed things like missile capabilities and you know, Chinese research vessels. Why was it important, do you think, that people knew in such detail about that sort of stuff?
I think, you know, by and large, the Micronesian region, at least for, you know, English-speaking audiences, is pretty much a secret. It's been a national security secret, I think, on the U.S. side for a long time. You know, Americans really don't even know much about Guam. So, you know, the point is to sort of really lay out what the landscape looks like in this geopolitical competition between the United States and China. The United States is able to operate in the region without any diplomatic approval in terms of its military activities. So that makes this entire region a target in the event of conflict. So the idea here is to sort of lay all of that out for interested parties to look at, to review, and have regular updates on what's occurring.
And what was the current need for this map? Was there a big sort of information gap relating to this kind of competition and military activity that currently existed within your region that, I guess, your mainstream media just sort of wasn't able to get a hold of quite well?
the Pacific Center for Island Security was formed because there was a void in the region. There's really not a regional think tank in the North Pacific. There's plenty of people in the South Pacific that are looking at the issues there, but there's none in the North Pacific. And yet it's in the North Pacific that the geopolitical competition is actually most combustive. If there's conflict in the Pacific, it's likely going to be in the North Pacific. So, we wanted to fill the void in terms of providing information about what's occurring here. And I think typically what happens is there's not a lot of depth in the region as a whole. You get sort of stovepiped, oh, we're doing this here and this is happening there, but there's nothing that pulls that all together. So, our platform with the mapping piece was to sort of bring all those items together so people had a more holistic view of what is occurring.
So what kind of impact has that up until now had on the culture of the people within Guam? Do they just kind of live in sort of like an ignorant and bliss in hope that nothing will ever happen, but knowing at the same time that there is a strategic threat that's posed to them?
Guam has a very complicated relationship with the U.S. military. Let's be clear. Guam is a U.S. colony. Efforts by the local government to change Guam's status, to establish a sovereign status for the island, have repeatedly been rebuffed by the United States. The U.S. military in Guam controls about, a third of the island. And this has gone on now for 80 years. So the relationship with the military is very complicated. In terms of transparency about what the military is doing, it's not particularly transparent. And then there's, multiple knock-on effects that are occurring at the local level that we seek to highlight. For example, the U.S. military buildup in Guam is occurring without adequate housing for military personnel. And that is putting a squeeze on our local housing market. In fact, it's driving prices up and it's driving probably people away from the island because it's simply not affordable. So there are many levels at which, we want to highlight the local concerns. And I think in the current geopolitical context, it's clear that whereas in the past, the U.S. military presence in Guam itself might have been seen as a deterrent, modern technology, particularly missile technology, now makes U.S. presence in Guam an attractive target. And that makes the civilian population a target. So I think people are beginning to think a little differently about how we approach these questions. And one of the things that is the top of the list of things that the U.S. military has fallen down on is that although there's a lot of talk about Guam being the shield and the defense of Guam, there's not a single cent in U.S. funds that have come to Guam to prepare the island with shelters or food resiliency, for example, in the event of a conflict. Mm-hmm. So we make it our point to raise these kinds of issues, and the map is sort of an extension of that.
And that was Leland Bettis, a director at the Guam-based think tank, the Pacific Center for Island Security, and he was speaking with Carl Evans. Now, you can actually check out the map when it launches on Thursday at the Pacific Center for Island Security's website. Well, as we touched on earlier in the show, Samoa's Prime Minister Lauli Alemaliatoa Leautia Schmidt is back in the country after 8 weeks in New Zealand receiving medical treatment. But that's not why he's making headlines at the moment. He was at the centre of a public confrontation with members of the country's daily newspaper, the Samoa Observer, on the weekend, which allegedly saw journalists threatened and the paper's editor assaulted outside the Prime Minister's house. The PM has since announced a ban on the Samoa Observer from covering his press conferences, accusing it of publishing misleading articles. Now, to get a clearer picture of what's unfolded, we are joined by the editor of the Samoa Observer, Shalveen Chan, who has phoned in from Apia. Talofa, Shalveen, and welcome to the show.
Talofa lava. Good to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I do want to start with the ban itself. Like, how were you informed, and did that actually come as a surprise?
Well, it was a surprise coming, him making an announcement that he's giving us a ban. But given the fact that, that is not going to stop the work of journalists, it may be a bit difficult getting him, but it doesn't really stop the work that we are trying to do, because we are trying to be the voice of the people and trying to highlight what the country needs. And we're also trying to hold the government to account as well. So the ban, yes, it may make things a bit more difficult, but it doesn't really put a stop to what we are trying to do.
Shalveen, look, I know that the Prime Minister gave a list of reasons as to why he imposed the ban, but do you think it was actually in response to the confrontation at his home over the weekend?
Well, yeah, one, well, it, it added on to that. But I think it really all began when we started questioning the publication of a doctored image of him when he was meeting with the foreign minister of New Zealand, Winston Peters. Those questions remain to be unanswered, and he feels that we have tarnished his reputation by asking those questions. Well, he's the leader of the nation and he needs to answer to the people, and that's where we come in. We hold him to account and we ask those questions, whether he may like it or not. But yeah, I guess so.
Well, showing up to his house that on the weekend, was that the reason why you wanted to ask those questions?
No, well, the thing was that he was away for 8 weeks and there was no real sort of correspondence from him to the people of Samoa directly. He chose to speak to New Zealand-based social media broadcasters, which he favours. He spoke to them, but there was no real questions and answers. He made statements, and there was this lack of communication. People did genuinely want to know how he is, how his health was, and that was the reason why we were there. We tried to make it to the airport, but we missed him because he was whisked away. And we just went there with a good intention to say, "Hi, PM, how are you? And how your treatment has been." There was no malice or anything to him or to dog him with serious questions. I guess he just didn't like it.
Well, let's chat about that confrontation, Shaveen. You know, the article has been shared widely. I know it's caused a stir, but could you give us a breakdown of what actually took place?
Well. My staff, my journalist, Manawi Faulalu, she was the one who was actually who went up to the gate and approached the police. And in her company was BBC journalist Dr. Mandeep Rai, who was actually doing a book on values all over the world. And she was talking about doing a little bit on Samoa, adding onto her book how Samoa's families and relationship actually of and the values of service actually give value. So that's what one of her book she was there for. So we just asked, and the journalist was told to go away. I arrived on the scene because Manawi had asked me to bring camera lenses. So I just came in to drop off the camera lenses. The drop put the camera lenses in a bag, and by the time I was walking back to my car, two unidentified men came out of the gate, and they straight away started to push me around. I guess they didn't push the Manawi and them around because they were ladies. I got pushed around and had the door slammed onto my face. And what was surprising was that even the police were present there. They did not do anything.
Wow. Shaveen, and again, it sounds like you were physically confronted again by those two men. Were you in any way hurt? If so, I mean, have you actually filed a report into the incident?
Well, the door in the face of the jaw still hurts, but I have filed an official complaint with the police, and I'm hopefully that they do their due diligence and do their investigations.
We spoke to our reporter, Adele Fruin, there earlier in the show about whether it's common or it's uncommon to approach the Prime Minister's house. Did you feel it was necessary to approach the Prime Minister at his home?
Well, we have done it before. We have approached FIMA at a house, and if the need be, we approach any sort of minister at their home, because at the end of the day, I mean, they're public figures and they work for the public and they should answer to the public. So if there are serious matters or matters that need to be highlighted, for example, a prime minister who was away for 8 weeks, just want to say, "Hi, Prime Minister, welcome back. Do you have anything to say to the people?" Things like this. I mean, if Albanese goes to the USA and he comes back, I'm sure journalists are waiting for him at the airport.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking to the editor of the Samoa Observer, Charlene Chan, in regards to allegedly seeing journalists threatened and the paper's editor himself assaulted outside the Prime Minister's house. Charlene, look, the PM was in New Zealand, right, for a long time receiving their treatment. Were you actually getting regular updates on his status, or do you feel like you were kept in the dark during his absence?
Well, he did initially, the first 2 weeks, he did update on his health, that he was walking and all that. But after that, there were no regular updates, so to go on. And There was no government. We confirmed this with the Ministry of the Prime Minister and the Cabinet. There were no government officials or no press secretariat officials with him to actually who could actually give us any information. And it was also confirmed that he's on a medical trip in his capacity as the Prime Minister, but he did hold curtsy calls from the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Christopher Luxon, and even Winston Peters. He even met with activist Arthur Nayatha on his movement where he's hoping to get Pacific Islanders 3 months visa on arrival in New Zealand. So he did meet with those people, but in terms of regular updates and being in contact with the media, that we feel was not there.
Mm. Are you confident, though, the paper can now really can still properly operate without access to the Prime Minister?
Oh, yes. I mean, the history of Samoa, so, but we've been at this road before. And as long as we know what we are doing, we're working for the people. I mean, we're trying our best to ensure that the people of this nation are well informed, that they know where their money is spent. If there's corruption, we highlight it. And if any lines are crossed, we also, I mean, we highlight it as well. And if people are not, for example, if people are not getting their medicine, if the medicine is in short supply, if they're not getting food at the hospital, or if there's illegal dumping going on, causing environmental damages, and if somebody's child has been beaten up and he's in ICU and the police have not done anything, we still continue to highlight those things. The work of the media does not stop over there, because the people, at the end of the day, people are affected by the policies that are made, and these policies need to be well consulted with. The people need to have a say in it, and most of all, people need to understand how these things actually going to affect them. Mm. So our role as journalists, as the media, does not really stop, because, you know, I mean, the government, they just need to accept the fundamental truth that freedom for people depends on the freedom of the press. Mm-hmm. And freedom and independent journalism is an essential public good. It's also the backbone, you know, of you know, things like accountability, mm-hmm. justice, equality, and human rights. I mean, there must be, with journalists, we must be able to report freely without fear or favor.
I was just saying, do you think, Shelvin, that this treatment of the PM, is it reflective of how he's treated media in the past, though?
Well, during his campaign, when he was campaigning as a leader of the FAST party, there were certain occasions where we actually caught him out and we questioned him about the statements he had made which were untrue. And one of those statements he made about the former Prime Minister, in which the former Prime Minister is actually taking him to court and suing him for $550,000. So those kind of things, we caught him out and we highlighted that. And during those days, he actually banned us from coming at any FAST party events or FAST party press conferences.
Well, then, do you think it's indicative of how he will actually treat media going forward? What do you think?
Well, I hope, because late yesterday afternoon, he issued another statement saying he was only temporarily suspending the Samoa Observer, and he hopes that there are changes. We hope that the Prime Minister himself, I mean, he's been chosen by the people to lead. He's been chosen, and the majority of Samoans have voted for him. So he's our chosen leader. And I hope that as we move forward, he realizes the role the media play and the need for him to be transparent to us, because transparency itself will also breed in accountability, and that is what we want. We want accountability from the government. We want to highlight things like corruption. I mean, as a social issue, meth is a big is just increasing on a daily basis in Samoa, and one of the key factors over there is corruption within the public service, or within where the border is, or workers at port. There's also issues about children not going to school, child vendors, the cost of education being high. There's not enough doctors. There's not enough teachers. We want to keep highlighting these things, not because we want to demean the government. We've done it for the past government and the government before that. What we want to do is highlight these issues so these issues can be worked upon and sound policies can be made, which in the long term help the people of Samoa, absolutely, not burden them as well. Yeah,
absolutely. Look, that we've come to the end of the show, Shelvin, but we really appreciate you coming on and sharing what has been happening there in Samoa.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. I mean, we have nothing against the government. We just want them to be transparent to us so we can let the people know. And we want the people of this country to be well informed of what is happening so they can make the right decisions themselves.
Thank you, Faftai Lava. That is the editor of Samoa Observer, Shelvin Chan, which brings us to the end of the show. We will be back same time, same place at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because, as always, your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, otoa o whaato. This is Aki Tupou on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.